Although you're full of misery, you mustn't show a trace of sadness, and never look for sympathy. You've got to learn, although it's very hard, the way of pocketing your pride. Sometimes face humiliation while you were burning up inside. Facing reality is often hard to do when it seems happiness is gone. You've got to learn.
The great Nina Simone with You've Got to Learn. It's from her 1965 album, I Put a Spell on You. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It took 15 hours of pleading by Senate Democrats yesterday before Republicans agreed to consider two gun control measures that would add controls on licenses and background checks for people buying guns. Senator Chris Murphy, the junior senator from Connecticut, noting that almost 4 years after the massacre of 20 schoolchildren and 6 staff members at the Sandy Hook Elementary School in his home state, he said, "We have done nothing, nothing at all, to reduce the likelihood that that will happen again to another family," unquote. But of course we know it has happened again, and it did happen again just 3 days before Murphy's filibuster. 49 people were killed and 53 others wounded in a mass shooting on June the 12th at a gay nightclub in Orlando, Florida. Omar Mateen, 29 years old, the alleged lone gunman, mowed down his victims with a military-style assault rifle and a high-powered handgun, even though he had been, at one point, on not just one, but 2 federal watch lists. So we're going to be talking today about this quandary that plagues gun control legislative efforts in the United States, and whether here too we are being manipulated into thinking that there is some legislative way to prevent these kinds of things happening. The list is very long of mass killings in the United States, almost all of them committed with high-powered guns. But the gun is iconic in American culture. It is the way people get their way. It is the way people get things done. It is the way America subdues the enemy. It is the way the native population was kept in check by the likes of John Wayne. But in reality, it is also the way in which we continue to be controlled as a society, and certain aspects of our society, certain communities in our society, particularly communities of color. The gun is an important symbol, not only of authority and power over these communities, but within these communities, it is also a major cause of self-annihilation. So the gun is a very important icon because it is associated with so much of the psyche of America. There are all kinds of rules, but these rules have not prevented these mass killings from happening, nor, I would argue, nor will they guarantee that they will not happen. Because there seems to be that we need to be asking some different questions here about why we have such a gun-obsessed culture. How did this come to be? And why are we pretending today that somehow this, as they call it now, gun violence is both new to us as a culture, it is being presented as a new, a relatively recent development, and secondly, that there are ways to control it. And still within that argument, we have the countervailing argument of the gun also being iconic of the argument about individual freedom and democracy. That, in, as a matter of fact, that's the whole point of the NRA, is it not? The right to bear arms, which of course clearly was enacted during the time of the citizen militia, transferred to that segment of America that sees, that's white male America, that sees itself practically ordained by God to dominate, control, and rule. The gun is both a symbol and an agent of that power. It is unlikely to be dislodged from the American psyche. It is one and the same. America is about guns. I mean, even the president, in his most recent visit to Asia, what did he do? He was able to stretch out the hand of friendship to Vietnam and agree to sell them guns. Not food. You know, not books, but guns. Because America and its obsession with guns and the connection, the psychological connection with guns, has also had a global effect. Other nations adopted the same thinking. Just today, I was reading that a British lawmaker was shot dead over what seemed to be a discussion about the direction of the country, and they had a community meeting. Somebody, some man in the audience appeared to disagree with her. On, you know, as we talked about the British exit or Brexit and the vote on leaving the European Union has fired up people to such a degree, this man just shot and killed her. We have all kinds of parallel illnesses and craziness now associated with guns. The assumption that, well, a gun owner, therefore, because you have to go through a ritual of licensing, is the same person. In the same way we assume that any presidential candidate is a person of high moral character. I mean, you've got to be insane to think that. But we do, and we are encouraged to think that way. So that when these arguments are coming up, and they're coming up with greater frequency now in the aftermath of the shooting in Orlando, we find that sometimes the arguments are not making sense. They're totally conflicting, just on the basis of logic. How did Omar Mateen get a gun despite the fact that he was on a watch list? Well, then the other question is, how and why was he on a watch list? What is this watch list? How do you get to be on a watch list in a democratic society without charges being formally proffered against you and your right to defend yourself? So a very undemocratic process produces a consequence that is meant to enable and safeguard the democratic process. See how illogical it is. But yet, this is the norm. How do we get to this discussion, a proper discussion, an intelligent discussion about gun control? And does it make sense to position the question this way, gun control? Now, the implication here is so frightening that I think people don't want to touch it. The fact that it is the ultimate, though perverted, sense of democracy, is it not? That one individual can arbitrarily change the course and even end life for hundreds and hundreds of people. Can summarily do it. This guy walks into a nightclub and kills 49 people and wounds 53 others and is killed himself. All of this is with guns. He arbitrarily decided this is what he had the power to do. The gun gave him that power. Well, how do you get an understanding of that? And why are we not connecting the current arguments about guns with the history and the role of the gun in creating this nation? Like I said, we had any number of citations in the media of this being the deadliest mass shooting in history, in U.S. history. It's an absolute lie, a total misrepresentation of history. The nation was founded on on gun violence. People left Britain with guns. Peace-loving, good Christians that they were. They came here and quickly adopted the idea that they had to obliterate everybody that they saw because the intention was to take their land, everything on it, in it, under it, over it, and around it. And that was not going to be a process of negotiation. I want my way, I will get my way, I will blow you away to get my way. That's basically the philosophy, the guiding principle of the gun and other related weapons of war. Make no mistake, they were prepared for war. But is it just about guns or about the psychology that informed the use of the gun that we ought to be taking a look at? Nice Christian people. The bulk of the violence done, gun violence in America, the history of gun violence in America is decidedly Christian. Fine, upstanding, God-fearing, God-believing, Bible-thumping people. But we will never see these horrible acts of violence and genocidal. They go beyond mass killings and mass murders. These are genocidal acts of violence. They will never be posited and positioned and discussed as such. In fact, they're completely removed from the historical record as gun violence. They don't exist. Gun violence began just the other day, if you look at the legislative response to guns. It became a problem just the other day. And it became a problem when white people were blowing other white people away. with guns in greater than expected numbers. We cannot deny the racial history here of guns and gun violence and gun ownership and all the things associated with guns. Guns as an agent of racial genocide, ethnic cleansing, self-annihilation, of world domination. That's how important the gun is to American culture, to Western culture, by extension. So when we hear of these efforts, these legislative initiatives to talk about gun violence, and the president really irritates me with this business of gun violence. Police are committing gun violence all over this country with impunity. We do not hear of major initiatives that are meant to yield some kind of structural improvement in this problem, some practical solutions here, some cultural shift about that. Not at all. A uniform gives you special dispensation to use a weapon of war in and on your fellow citizen. That's gun violence. We have not even talked about related kinds of military violence that has been systematically conducted all throughout U.S. history, all throughout European contact with this continent and its first peoples. According to the media, the issue of gun violence emerged as a national concern just the other day. It didn't exist before 2004. Everything was under control until about 2000, the turn of the age. Before that, everything was fine. Well, what accounts for this? What accounts for this change? And how do we honestly discuss, quote, gun violence, unquote? How do we honestly discuss this? People want solutions, but they don't want to define the problem. Nor do they want to put the problem in proper historical, social, political context. How do we presume as a nation to legislate, logically legislate? Well, actually, that's a contradiction right there. Logic and legislation, they don't go together very often. But how do you begin to have any sensible conversation about a problem that you won't admit, the history of which you will not deal with, the truth of which you will not deal with? How do we begin to discuss this? They tell us the problem is about licenses. Is it? This young man, Omar Mateen, was able to get his hands legally on assault weapons. Well, why does he have assault weapons? Well, I mean, the logic of it is so clear. You want to kill as many people as possible in one fell swoop, which is the reason the weapon was invented in the first place. The police actually had hollow point bullets. Were they necessary? According to them, yes. Because when they shoot a person, they want that person dead. They want the insides ripped up so badly there's no chance of survival or patching the person up. When they shoot, it's not to disable, it is to kill. I mean, that's the logic of it. So why are we talking as if we don't understand the logic behind the invention of these many, multiple ways of killing? Killing is American. This is the truth. This is where we need to start. Well, Omar Mateen seems to be on the terrorist list. Okay. Let's say he was on a terrorist watch list. But why are we redefining terrorism now? To mean Arab-speaking people or people of Arabic extraction, people who are affiliated in some way, say that they practice Islam or embrace Islam as their religious teachings. Why are we now engaging in that? Terrorism is also the guy with the blue uniform affiliated with the police department. Terrorism is also the Ku Klux Klan. This is the history of the United States. I'm not inventing this. It began as a terrorist organization. It still exists, and it still is not classified as a terrorist organization, despite the fact that just last year, an identified race extremist named Dylan Roof walked into a black church and blew 9 people away, including an elected state senator who also happened to be pastor of the church. That was a terrorist act. That was a political assassination committed by an avowed racist, affiliated with a terrorist philosophy and terrorist group that still exists. So why is it still there? Because the Klan qualifies, racist as it is, it qualifies as having the right to exist, because we're still very much involved in protecting people's constitutional rights. We see the legislative and legal conundrum that we create. We're not clear. We're talking about the need to do all these things in the name of freedom, justice, and equality. But look what you got. You have terrorist police departments. You actually have that. There's a trial going on right now in Baltimore, the central theme of which is that 6 officers and their related supervisors conspired to torture a man to death and cause injuries to him in a police van. This was their method of torture, to snap his neck and snap his spine. What do you call that? That's terrorism in uniform. We heard about the buildings in Chicago where the police would take people they arrest and torture them. It was known. We have had reports, we discussed it here on this program, of the various torture programs engaged in by the United States. That's terrorism. This is what I'm talking about. These are acts of terror, and the historical record documents wholesale attacks on entire communities. You don't believe me? Read a little bit about Greenwood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Considered one of the wealthiest communities, bar none, black, white, or polka dot,
in the United States. It happened to be in an all-black town. Burned to the ground. Burned to the ground in 1921. Or Rosewood, Florida, where every living thing in that black community was just about annihilated by roving bands of white terrorists. But in 1921 in Tulsa, even the government joined the crazies and exceeded the terrorist act by literally dropping a bomb. It's the first instance of the U.S. government bombing its own citizens on its own soil. That's not going to appear in your history books as a point of reference about terrorism now. All through the 60s, all through the 50s, days of slavery and so forth, we have act upon act upon act of terror. Government-permitted terror, government-initiated terror, and citizen terror protected by the government. So when we see this horrific act in Orlando, we have to put these things in perspective. Because even acts of terror now, which are being, how should I say, the responsibility of which has been highly personalized. In other words, in reporting these things, they said, well, this guy, this individual, made an individual choice. And he must be punished. And there's no denying that. You can't deny that. That is a fact. He made an individual choice. But we would be crazy to think that this was an exceptional choice. That it was the first time we'd seen this kind of violence. Or that we have been given what would amount to be a bizarre rationale for this level, this intense level of violence. We'd be crazy to think that. History, U.S. history, is replete with violence of awe-inspiring proportions. The president just came back again from visiting Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Hello. So, mass killing is deeply ingrained in the American psyche, military and otherwise. We understand killing. In fact, there's a bizarre joke about the Texas defense where the judge asks, "Why did you kill this man?" And the defendant answers, "Your Honor, he needed killing." Even in the humor, we tolerate violence. We expect it. There's a certain sense of Christian retribution in violence, a sense of righteousness about it. Now, the shift that is occurring, if we dare say that we look at violence in its, and this particular incident in perspective, what we can see here is a particular kind of shift that is worth knowing because it is also occurring globally more and more frequently, where individuals are arrogating to themselves the authority of governments and carrying out acts of violence on the order of governments. We have to understand this. We are being encouraged to see these things as acts of terrorism. But look at it, really. It's individuals making up their minds to do these horrible things in the way that governments do. Except they're the government. They're the power. And they place themselves on par with the power of governments to inflict violence. In other words, in the same way that the U.S. as a government can, for example, carry out drone attacks that indiscriminately kill people in pursuit of one person, let's say. Well, they just kill people because it's a strategic target of terrorism. They inflict terrorism in pursuit of terrorism. Individuals now who can put at their disposal, who can get their hands on weapons to inflict violence at a very high level, are doing just that. They're operating as renegade governments. Arbitrary renegade governments. This guy got up in the morning and he knew what would happen by the end of the day because he had everything at his disposal to make it happen. No amount of legislation could tackle that and prevent that. But what we can do is we can begin to have an honest conversation here. We certainly can correct the historical record and not repeat these stupid things presented to us as facts about this being the deadliest mass shooting in U.S. history. I was most offended by that because in one fell swoop, racism superseded even a need to follow good journalistic principles. Your facts are wrong. Your information is totally wrong. But you do that because you do not want to incur the wrath of the system by saying, you know, this is replete in U.S. history. This level of violence, this kind of violence. And it has been a democratic process. The government has done it. Individuals have done it. Groups have done it. And with alarming regularity when you look at the historical record. And while we lament the carnage in terms of the numbers, we also have to keep in mind two things. The weapons were designed for that purpose, to increase the numbers of dead and wounded people, to inflict the greatest amount of damage in the shortest amount of time. There was a whole industry, for crying out loud, that is devoted to ways in which you can kill the most people ever. There's a whole industry dedicated to the science and methodology of death. That is part of American culture. That is part of our economic world here. That is a thriving economic sector. Killing. And the machines of killing and the methods of killing. It's very American. So how you legislate all of this is something that we need to discuss. Is it possible to legislate this? Is it possible to prevent these acts from happening? And are these legislators being sincere and practical when they say that these measures are necessary in order to prevent these things from happening? I mean, I feel it's a conundrum. They, as this legislator, Senator Murphy, said, 4 years have passed by since we saw 20 students and 6 administrators and teachers killed. Nothing has been done, despite the fact the president has been there and whatnot. So we have other forces at play that have the power to change both the discourse and the response to a growing national problem. What is the right way, or what is a most effective way to approach a solution here? And what exactly are we solving? What do we aim to solve? I also want to note something, because as a journalist, it struck me as very, very much in line with what I routinely talk about, and it's the racism of the media. And I don't want to sound petty, but it's to be noted. We had 49 people killed, 53 wounded, many of them very seriously wounded. The vast majority of them were Latinos, specifically Puerto Ricans. It is a major story by any definition. And yet, I have yet to see a Puerto Rican face in authority of the story, telling the story as an organic presence in the community with the authority to report on it from a cultural perspective. All the liberal media have seized upon it, and they're telling the story. And they have almost exclusive rights to the story. And I can't help but ask the question, where's your diversity now? Why am I not seeing a Puerto Rican reporter, a Spanish-speaking reporter, a Latina or Latino reporting on the story? Where is your diversity? It turns out the authorities on the story I saw just yesterday, Rachel Maddow on MSNBC, is in charge of the story. And as the liberal media would tend to do, this is because it is such a huge story. They want their imprint on it, and they want exclusivity. So they do what they routinely do. They lock everybody else out. Rachel Maddow is very active in the gay community. On CNN, we have, Anderson Cooper taking charge of the story. I don't see meaningful Latino input there in the story. Nobody's telling the story from a gay Latino point of view. Not that because it's gay people, you have to have only gay people report on it. But in as much as it is a gay story, and in as much as the overwhelming majority of the victims of this crime and survivors of this crime are Latinos, and specifically people of Puerto Rico, what is the problem having them tell the story? So when in the so-called liberal media, you have racism here too. It's as if there is nobody, there's not one qualified person in the entire Latino world at any of the so-called major media people covering the story who can tell the story themselves in a more authoritative and culturally consonant way. They are out. Because it comes down to, this is a big story, and it's going to look good on my resume as having reported exclusively on it. I'm in charge. Let me remind you that stories such as this end up being the first draft of history. That's what I always advise reporters at my paper. We will be doing, not just reporting. These are documents that we are producing that are of historical merit. So we were very careful and very mindful of the fact that we have a responsibility to just that, to honor the integrity of the historic nature of what it is we're reporting. I look at media coverage of this event, it's as if Puerto Rican journalists don't exist, or that they're not entitled to tell their story. White gays have decided this is their thing. They speak for the gay movement. They are the natural representatives of the gay world. And they will select who and when enters, when they enter, who enters and when they enter the story. But they're in charge of it. This is very sad. And it is important to note it because it means that journalistically there has been no movement at all in the newsrooms of America. Well, we should expect by now some degree of representation that allows any story, no matter where it occurs, to have across-the-board input, authoritative input. But particularly because we see how and where the story is originating, we see how important it is at this particular time, to be culturally relevant and sensitive. But in the meantime, we see the white media operating the way they always have. We're locking you out. We are the people creating history. We are the people creating the historical record. We are the people regulating information and the so-called news. And for no reason other than we have situated ourselves as leaders within the gay community. And we have to perform for the gay community, i.e., the white gay community. I'm sure the white gay community does not see itself that way. I'm sure they understand the symbolism of the rainbow flag. But you're not seeing rainbow coverage here. There is no rainbow coverage going on. It's the same old standard racism, even in liberal media. So, these are some of the thoughts that I have today. And I want to bring these things to your attention as they unfold. They are for us. A case study, all these little things, these groupings of topics that we are looking at, all emanating from the same source, how this thing is being managed, how our perceptions are being managed, how we see racism even in the people who say they're responding to racism. That's the white-dominated media. we see the corruption of the definition of terrorism. We see the altering of the historical record, that you could lift any story out of its appropriate context, as if this is just what you need to know, and you don't need to know anything else. We even talked about the philosophy of violence in the United States, and how it is connected to this enduring principle of domination and control. This is what it's all about. So whether it happens at a local level or a global level, the philosophy that informs it has now been democratized. Everybody is thinking along the same lines. With weapons, I can achieve what entire governments achieve. I can achieve as one individual. I can inflict proportionately the same level of violence as any organized government. We see the effort being made to condition our thinking. Well, he declared, this is Mateen in reference to Mateen, he declared allegiance to ISIS. Yes, but he's also, we see clear indications that he was not mentally well. He was also, in the middle of all of this, looking and contacting his Facebook page to find out if he's being followed, if he's going viral. This quest, which is also very American, this obsession with self and ego, and the idea that you're looking for stardom. As if simply declaring himself and declaring his allegiance to ISIS means that he is a man of ISIS. No, you're not. You're just another tool. The deal is, you could declare all you want, but in the end, you got to go. You're dead, too. You could see the irrationality of it all. But we are being asked to accept the seriousness of this, as if he were, in fact, given papers by ISIS to perform this dastardly act as an agent of ISIS. No, no such thing. No such thing. And they're not being honest about it. This is the act, like we've seen in so many cases of mass murder, the act of a person who basically has gone out of his mind. Whether propagandized, whether he just decided this is something he wants to do, whether he sees his act as a way of being remembered or adding some kind of cachet to his name post-mortem, whatever. The fact is that in his act, we see a frightening parallel, and he's not the first such candidate. But individuals have come to understand that they can act as governments arbitrarily. They have the wherewithal to do so with weapons that inflict massive amounts of death and suffering, which is the point of these guns. That you can dispatch as many people as possible, and that gives you some perverted sense of satisfaction. But it is no more or less perverted than the rationale that we have gotten from the organized democratic government that goes to war, that has accounted for the deaths of tens of thousands of U.S. citizens, sending them off to Vietnam, sending them to Afghanistan, sending them to all corners of the world to specifically kill people. So does one form of gun violence become all the more distasteful than another form of gun violence? That's the question. Are we against gun violence? Then we should be against gun violence across the board. Are we to believe that this is especially pernicious? Well, let's take a look at history. What does our history tell us that we ought to do to fix this? Is it even fixable? Do we have to confront some ugliness that we really don't want to even uncover anymore? We don't want to talk about these things. And that's why we have a media, a very compliant press, that makes us intentionally ignorant of our history. So that we are talking about the wrong things. We are distracted. We are concerned about things we can't fix. And we fix things that are of little concern. And that's where we are. We have to start asking these questions. And we have to keep our minds open to the fact that when these situations occur, as awful as they are, and they're very awful, it is in the interest of the system to keep us all in check. So we are distracted. We're given information about things that are really of no major importance. It doesn't put us any closer to understanding the problem. There will be no discussion of the real problem. They don't have the time for that, and it's not really advantageous to engage in a discussion of the real problem underlying all of these acts of violence. It's too embarrassing, uncomfortable. And a lot of myths would be blown apart when we start taking these incidents apart and we see what the connective tissue looks like. It's very ugly. And so this is where I leave you today, just to think about these things. And this week we've been talking about it. Tomorrow, of course, is Free Your Mind Friday. And I'd like us to kind of round out the week about how we have been taking this horrible development, this horrible crime committed in Orlando, the various aspects that we've discussed here, what you're thinking about it, and especially in this election year, where the events, as tragic as they are great grist for the political mill, so that even in death, these victims and the survivors as well get no dignity. There's no dignity here for them. What does that say about us as a so-called progressive community? What is the work that needs to be done here? How should we be thinking about these things? These are the questions we ask ourselves at a time like this. And if we at least summon up the bravery to look at the festering sore, pull the scab back a bit and look at it. We have to confront the historical record and our past and how it relates to where we are today. So thanks for listening. I really appreciate your indulgence in giving me the space and time to stretch out on these topics. Stay tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me via email at leadstories@gmail.com. Again, tomorrow being Free Your Mind Friday, get your brains in gear. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company, and I value it immensely. We'll see each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.
What good is thinking of tomorrow?